When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Support for Analog Talk comes from Filmstock. Have you been scouring camera shops looking to find a certain film camera? Struggling to find a film stock of your favorite film? Filmstock checks the inventory of used film cameras and film stocks at trusted shops nationwide. When it finds a camera that matches what you're looking for, you get notified immediately. Filmstock even helps you find the best price on your favorite film stocks, like Porsche 400 or CineStill 800T. It's free to get started. Sign up for Filmstock today at filmstock.app. FILMSTOCK.app. And for a limited time, they're offering Analog Talk listeners a 25% discount on Filmstock Plus. Use the code Analog Talk. Finally find that elusive film camera with Filmstock.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Analog Talk, a film photography podcast. I'm your host, Tim.
I'm Chris.
And on today's show, we have Lucia Rallo. Hey, Lucia.
Hi, Lucia.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for joining us. We're super excited to chat with you. A lot of exciting things that you've done in the film community. But before we get to all that, do you mind giving our listeners a background on who you are and how you got into photography?
I'm Lucia Rallo. And I guess I got my first camera when I was like 4 years old or something. And then I got into the darkroom when I was in like middle school. And then I moved to New York and I studied photography at the School of Visual Arts. I got out like right when the economy collapsed. And
oh, yeah, I remember that. those times.
Right. So, yeah. So there were no jobs and I had no money. And so I built a darkroom. Now it's been 10 years.
So you got started. Years. You said you got your first camera at 4 years old?
Like around there. Yeah. I remember it was like shortly after my brother had been born. And I'm like a little less than 3 years older than him. And my friend's parents came to visit and they brought one of those like long, skinny, I forget what they are. They take that obnoxious 110 film.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember like getting that and being like, just like totally obsessed. And like, I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, down the street from the MIT Museum, where they had all the photographs of like the bullets going through the apples and all that flash photography shit. Cause it was where it was invented and whatnot. So it was just like this kind of like thing around me for my whole life. And then I went to the summer camp when I was like 12 and they had a dark room and I was like, I want to get in there. And that was kind of just that.
It's crazy. You got bit by the bug real early.
Yeah.
I thought I was early at 16, you know, that I figured out that I had this passion for photography, but at four and 12, like, that's crazy.
I was just like, oh, I can do this. And I like this. And it was sort of like, I don't know. My parents were pretty like, you know, at each other when I was a kid. So it was like a safe, quiet, dark space that I didn't have to like worry about interacting with other humans in. Oh, wow. But also like it was, you know, usually a shared space in a school. So there was some human interaction. It wasn't like totally isolating.
Was the summer camp the most my summer camp had was like swim class.
It was actually
the fact that there was like a dark room there is like, wait, what?
So because I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I went to public school in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but my mom's house was basically like equidistant between Harvard and MIT. So there were a lot of just like really good resources for public school kids. And it was this random city program that sent us out to Concord Academy for 5 or 6 or maybe even 8 weeks, like over the summer. And we did 5-day boarding out in Concord, Massachusetts, which is like 20 minutes from my mom's house. And then we came back home on the weekends and, I don't even have any real idea who actually paid for it, but it was funded by, you know, the city or the state or something. Like my parents didn't pay for it. And it was just like at this fancy private school during the summer. So they had like, you know, everything there. It was great. It was really cool.
Man.
Weird place to grow up.
I'm still stuck on the 110 camera. I didn't remember that. Like, I have that same story. That it was right? Like, I was a baby and I remember getting like, it was like the pack. I remember the pack. Yeah, it was just the hard plastic that you need like 17 machetes to get into to get the camera out of it. And I remember running around like a Thanksgiving or something with that and being like, I am the shit.
Yeah.
Like, I am awesome because I have this.
I
just can't imagine being like the counselor and like teaching a bunch of 12-year-olds like, this is fixer. This is don't put your fingers in here.
I think all the counselors were like, undergrads, like in college. I think they really were all like 18 to 23. So they weren't like actually that much older than us. I don't think adults, they really like knew what they were getting into either.
Do you still have work from that time period? Do you ever look back on that?
I don't know. I have all my binders from high school, but I don't know if I have my shit from before that. I might. I have piles of shit that I haven't gone through in years.
That would be cool.
And make me crawl up above the dark room and go through my garbage bags and binders.
Just because I, you know, it could be a cool project to like reshoot something like with adult eyes or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
I think I was shooting a lot of like flowers and doorknobs and gravestones.
Sure. Yeah.
12-year-old girl.
But everything at like a lower level, you know, like a 12-year-old level. Now you're taller. I don't know.
I haven't gotten that much taller since then.
I haven't either since I was 12. I realized that when I said I haven't grown. I'm still 5 feet.
Maybe an inch.
So obviously it's been a part of your life for a long time that you made the transition into art school. What was that like?
Going to art school?
Going to like doing photography in college, because I went to a photography school, but it took me a while to like figure out, because at that time, I mean, maybe probably still now, probably less so, but people, I didn't think you could go to school for photography. I remember when a friend of mine was like, oh, I'm going to this photography school. And I was like, what? I have built a dark room under my parents' stairs. I didn't know I could like do this for like a job, like a real, like I go like learn in school how to do this. So
like how'd I end up there kind of thing? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I was doing stuff like pretty seriously in high school. I went to boarding school after I went to this like summer boarding thing. I ended up going to boarding school for high school because the best boarding schools in the country are in New England. They had a really great dark room. I basically like picked my high school based on the like photo facilities because I was like, this is just what I want to do. Like, and I wasn't like really thinking about like jobs or whatever. My parents were like sort of hippies, but like not really, but like sort of artists, but also just crazy. So they were like sort of supportive of the idea of like doing photography, but there was also this part of them that was like, you need to go get a liberal arts degree. But I like was like so singularly focused throughout all of high school that I found the SVA Catalog School of Visual Arts, which is where I went when I was like a sophomore or something. And I was like reading through like all their electives and like all just like all of their like general course offerings, like history and psychology classes, like as well. And I was like, there's like a really diverse range of stuff that you can learn. You're not just going to school and studying photography. Like, they still have math and science requirements. They just have one math or science requirement instead of like a year. And I was like, cool, like I can do this. My brain won't like totally rot. And I don't know, I made the case. It wasn't like a very hard case to make to my parents. I was like, it's a trade as well as an art. Like, I'll have a job or I'll have job opportunities. I'll know, you know, like a full set of skills, whatever, whatever. And then I just like came here and I lived in the dorm on 23rd Street for a year, and then we moved into an apartment in Chinatown, and then I kind of like bounced around. And I don't know, I feel like my high school experience was more like most people's college experience, and then my college experience was just art school. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah,
like,
that makes sense.
There wasn't a whole lot of structure. I crammed all my classes into 2 days so I could like work the other five. Like,
wow.
I was always so jealous of friends. I have one friend in particular, Danielle, this girl that I went to school with, and she ended up going to RISD for, I just remember she did like basket weaving and crazy painting. And
cool.
And I was just like, You can go to college for that? Like, I had no idea that...
That was the thing.
I don't know. See, I wouldn't say that I was from a family... I didn't even go to college, so I'm not from one of those families that's like, you need to go to Harvard and get a degree in this.
Yeah.
It was... There was never any... Because they were like, shit, if he goes to college, we're screwed. We're going to have to pay $1 zillion for this. So they're like, don't you like working on cars or something? You know, they were trying to push me in a different direction. But it's just wild to think that, yeah, like you said, that there's school for that. That I don't know, man. I'm so jealous of that because, as I've said a million times on this show, I totally pissed my high school photography career down the drain just because of girls are pretty and there was one of them in my class. And I was just like, oh, I mean, I loved it. I loved the Bat Cave and the dark room and the fixer. And it was all like I was getting into it, but I just didn't care. So it's just neat that you kind of were on this like path, you know. It's I don't think it's like a very common story that we hear on the show, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, like growing up and like I just turned 35, right? So I like am sitting here like, okay, I'm like an adult now, and I like look at my like siblings and cousins and like they're all, you know, like give or take 3 years, say, and like most of them are still kind of just like, I don't know what to do with my life. I'm just kind of working a job. And I'm like, oh, well, I don't know what else I would do with my life.
Right.
But there's this one thing and it like works more than anything else has worked. Sort of.
Yeah.
I think it's less bad than anything else I've tried. So I'm just going to keep doing it.
Well, I mean, it makes so much sense why you are a darkroom owner. I mean, how did that all come about? Like, what's the story of the darkroom? How did that all blossom and bloom into what it is today?
I mean, I got out of school and like they let you use the darkrooms on campus in the photo building for the summer, I think, like 3 months. It's after you graduate, and then you're just like cut off, and
they're like, get out of here.
Yeah. So I was like, I don't know what the fuck to do. Like, I haven't not had a dark room, you know. Like, I had my like high school dark rooms. I set up like a pretty rudimentary one at my mom's house when I was in high school. But yeah, I like had basically never been without a dark room, and so I started trying to like go other places. But there was nowhere in Brooklyn, like at all. And so it was either like go to print space and pay like $22 an hour or something, which like it being 2009 and not being able to find a job and whatever was like a way too much money.
Yeah.
Or you like go downtown and go to ABC No Rio and pay $6 an hour, but they may or may not have anyone there to open the door for you when they say they will. So you may take this 45-minute trip and take two trains and a bus and get there and not find anyone there. So after that happened to me a few times, I was kind of like, this isn't really working. Like, and I don't like have the $22 an hour, because I wanted to go in and print for, you know, 4 to 8 hours or whatever. And I was like, I don't have $200 to just like drop on top of paper. Like, So now print space is gone and they gave us all their equipment. Full circle. But yeah, so I think it was like one day I was just like complaining to one of my neighbors, and she pointed out that in the basement of the loft building that we were living in, they had these like, I don't know, 6 foot by 8 foot closets that they rented out for $75 a month for people to use as storage units. And the one right next to the laundry room was available. And for some reason they rented it to me. I didn't tell them what I was going to do. I was just like, I want a fucking storage unit. And like, I cleaned it out and I coated the walls with plastic and like hooked up like extension cords through holes in the wall that like went to the laundry room. And then like eventually I built this little like sink thing that was on wheels so it could like hook up to the extra, like, because there were two washing machines but three spigots for washing machines, so you could just screw a hose and turn on this faucet. And then just like drain it into the floor. It like worked perfectly for and so that was just like a single occupancy like black and white setup. It was all I really like thought I needed, and it was all I need personally. But then it got like really busy. And
and this was still around 2009.
By the time I actually got it open, it was 2011.
Okay.
It was February of 2011.
I started getting back into film around 2012, so I was trying to like track it along with like the resurgence of film.
Right. Like, I feel like a lot of people started like getting back into it in 2012. And that's kind of when like the turnaround sort of started. Like, So if I opened in like February of 2011, it would have been summer of 2012 that we moved into our first. Yeah. We've been in four different spaces. So we had two ground floor spaces in this like little mini mall thing, Loom. And so we moved into our first one there. I think it was July of 2012, I want to say. And we were in that space for a year. And then we moved across the hall within that same complex. And we were there for like another 2 years, I guess. And then in February of 2015, we moved into the warehouse that we're in now.
So how is that? How is that moving into a place like being a dark room?
It's exhausting.
Because I know you said you didn't. Yeah.
Like, every time we moved, we had to rebuild the rooms.
Right.
You had to do all the framing. Yeah, you have to do all the plumbing. You have to do all the electric because it all has to be so specific. You can't just go into a space and like find a dark room. Like, nobody else wants one.
Yeah.
it would be in a school or an institution or something, you know, like. Yeah.
Now, did your landlord of the first one, when you were just in like the storage locker and they found out what you were doing, were they like, what the hell is going on here? Or were they kind of just cool with
they
it?
They were super into it, actually. And they owned.
Oh, awesome.
They also owned the building that was that had the second spaces that we moved into. And that was like a large part of how I was able to get the deal. He was like, it's like Hasidic Orthodox Jewish guy. It's Brooklyn, right? Like they're all.
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah,
and so he's like, I like your like whatever, like spunk or whatever. Like you're doing a cool thing here. And he like wasn't mad at all that I like hadn't asked him for permission. Yeah. So that ended up being really cool.
Because I kind of did the same in the little apartment before the last apartment I lived in. The apartment before that ended up taking over one of the whole entire bathrooms. And the landlord was kind of not cool about it because they would come in to check like the meters and stuff. And they're like, what? Because they were concerned more so of me polluting like the sinks. And I'm like, do you think I'm like that guy that's just going to dump this stuff down the drain? Like I have a guy, like I have a chemical guy. So don't worry, you know.
I don't think they like thought about that at all.
Yeah.
My landlord.
That's great.
Yeah, and the fact that it was in the basement made it so it could be like publicly accessible and whatever. So yeah, I think that was sort of part of the reason it was like, well, let's make this shared because I graduated with a whole bunch of other people and I'm sure some of them are still in the city. And I imagine a few of them are probably in a similar situation. And like, maybe I could get, you know, 10 people to pay $20 a month or something and not have to pay for my dark room.
Wow. Yeah. Genius. Yeah.
That was like
genius
the idea.
Yeah, I love it.
Just get myself like a free. And so now it's not free. I mean, it's free sort of. Right, like it pays for itself.
It's a trade-off. Yeah,
that's great.
How many stations do you have? How many enlargers?
In the black and white dark room, we have 8, and then we have a color dark room with 4 that are currently set up, but the potential for 5 or 6. And then we have a private dark room that has 2, and then we have a large format room that can do like giant mural prints.
Wow!
The next time I'm in New York, I'm coming for a visit.
Yeah, you gotta come.
It sounds like a dream.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Do you have like a? Well, I know during the pandemic, you guys were basically you kind of had to shift.
Yeah.
Right. You had to kind of shift to more of a drop your film off and we'll develop it.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Awful. No, I mean,
because everybody was shooting, right? Everybody was like had nothing else to do.
Yeah, it was like really quiet for like I don't know, like 2 or 3 weeks, and then it was like everybody like had started shooting at the same time, finished shooting, and then all decided to start mailing in their film like on the same day. And for like a couple of months there, I guess it was all just like kind of, you know, selfies and whatever, like in the mirror and whatever, like just like people being at home alone, isolated.
Yeah.
And then once the protests started, it was all that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So it kept like, it was a steady flow for like several months and it was really overwhelming. But I mean, it was good money. So it was cool. And
because a lot of, you know, think about a lot of businesses who had to just shut down and couldn't.
Yeah.
There was no other like.
Yeah.
Crazy to think about.
Yeah. I think a lot of the labs in the country like just shut down completely. And like,
I
don't know. I was just kind of like, what's going to happen? Like, I'll just keep doing this. It's just me, like, going back and forth between my house. Like, I'm not bothering anybody. Like, yeah. And then people figured out that they could nail us their film, and they did.
How are things now? Is everybody, I'm sure you have, like, COVID guidelines and all that stuff, but what is it? Is it back? Are people back being comfortable? And
they're definitely, like, coming back in. It's good. The last, like, few weeks, there have been a couple of people in kind of, like, all the stations for, like, a couple hours on, like, most days. And it's like, it's been, you know, until the last, like, few weeks, probably it's been like 1 to 5 people coming in and using the space each day. And now we're more like 5 to 10. So that's good, you know, and like they're spreading themselves out, and there's enough room in the building that people can spread themselves out. So yeah, I like it. I feel much better when the income revenue or whatever is coming from different types of things, not all just coming from film developing, you know, like I want it to be memberships and classes and rental and drop off, like all the things, so that we can, I guess, have something to fall back on if crisis hits. And I guess it works. I don't know. Seems to be working.
Was there ever a scary point during all of that where you were kind of just like, I don't know if this is going to make it? Or did you kind of just have enough with all the film developing stuff to not really
have
a chance to worry, like, about that?
I really didn't. Like, the feds gave us in May, they gave us like $13,000, I think, of idle money. That stuff. Oh, wow. So we've gotten a little bit of government money, and it's always been just like enough to be like, okay, cool, like cushion, like breathing space.
Right.
Like everything is really totally fine. Just keep going and like figuring it out.
It's great.
So
that's so scary to be, because that's, I don't know if we mentioned it since we've been talking, but we have done this interview before. We had a little bit of technical issues last time, and it's all coming back to me now that we're having the conversation again. I'm just like, oh, this is great. But I feel like even a couple weeks ago, or I mean, maybe it was even over a month or so ago, we were talking to you, and I feel like it was kind of in a different spot for you. And it feels good to hear that people are coming in and, things are finally kind of getting back to normal-ish.
Yeah, I feel like in the last, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks, there's been like a sort of shift where I've found myself like looking around and I'm like, hey, there are like 6 different people here at one time.
Yes.
And it's like, that's a huge relief, because it's like, that's why I started a community darkroom and not just like a fucking drop-off film lab, you know? And like, I didn't ever, like, having the film developing resources, like, clearly a core part of our business model or whatever, and it's definitely an important resource to offer and like whatever, but the community space is the reason to build, like, the business exists. It's not like, if I wanted a lab, I could do it in a shipping container on Central and Decolp, just like guy.
Totally. Yeah.
That's so hip.
So what's the hip thing to do. So I want to hear about the classes and stuff that you offer. Who is teaching those? Is that, do you have people to come in and do that? Are you doing that too? Or
I'm not doing that.
What are those like?
Yeah, no. They're basically all like former volunteers that were teaching classes in the before time or whatever. And most of the classes are still private, but we're sort of trying to add in more group classes. We're doing like a developing demo thing tomorrow with one of my old teachers from the School of Visual Arts.
That's gonna be cool.
Yeah, so I try and cover like the full spectrum, and like we had in the before time, I don't know what the fuck else to call it, we had like a 4-week series that was like how to use your camera, how to develop your film, and then 2 weeks on like how to make the prints. So basically I'm trying to like get back up to having that at least fully present again. But so far we're really just doing the developing and printing. The actual like intro to camera thing hasn't filled up when we've offered it.
That'd be such a cool thing to do, like at, like on a date night. Like we right. always, like we made candles when we were in Atlanta for our friend's wedding.
Cute.
And like, it was just like, we sat and like they were teaching us how to make the candles and everything. And it's like, that just like popped in my head like that, like, come learn how to shoot a roll of film and develop it and then go home with a print, you know, like, That's so cool.
Like pretty.
You can market it. You can take that marketing idea of it if you want. Date night develop. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Hopefully. I mean, it just like kind of depends on people's comfort level too, right? Like how many people we're actually going to get. Yeah. Seems like things are looking good. So fingers crossed, winter isn't too terrible.
Oh, yeah. I hope.
Love to hear it. So I want to talk about is the dark room your only gig, or do you do gigs outside of like the dark room for work? Do you do any shooting for money or?
Not really. Only like occasionally.
Yeah.
I did an event for a friend like 3 or 4 weeks ago. And like I assisted for a friend on a wedding in the spring. So like I'll do that kind of thing, but only occasionally and like for friends, because I'm just like, I don't operate well under that kind of stress. I kind of like tend to forget how to use my camera. And then what?
Yeah. Sometimes doing those side gigs will like reaffirm that you're like, I'm meant to do this community dark room and I'm cool with it, you know? And your art is your art. Kind of like Timothy.
Yeah.
You always say like photography is for you because you don't want to have it be tainted by the stress of it all, you know?
Yeah. And like trying to make images that like are what other people want, even though like they're hiring you because they like what you're already doing. So really it's not that stressful. Just do what you always do.
Right. Get out of your head. Well, look, can we talk about your art for a little while? I've been like fascinated by your gray series.
Oh yeah. I was supposed to like actually start that. I'm actually going to start that. I just have to like figure it out. I'm having like mixed feelings like about a lot of that.
Uh-oh.
Like NFT stuff. Yeah. I don't know. I realized I really, really don't like the one specific person that's like very, very involved in the NFT scene. And like if I'm gonna be like really involved in it, like I need to be in the same room as him, and I really don't want to be. So I don't know, I'm like kind of like mulling on that right now, but I have all these gum prints that are minted and like ready to go, so at some point I'm gonna figure out how to sell them.
That's right, the gum prints. Can you talk about that again, because that like blew my mind last we chatted.
Okay, so they're gum prints, which you make by mixing gum arabic with potassium dichromate and any color watercolor pigment. I usually use powder pigments. And not a lot of people, but some people, a few people, I think they have a class on it at Penumbra, do tricolor separation. So you can get like a color neutral gum print by using cyan, magenta, and yellow. I mean, I guess black, but that's not what I do at all. Cause like I learned it from this old woman in New Hampshire, and I guess I just got brainwashed or whatever. But I think that I start with black and white negatives. So I don't do tricolor separation. And then I just do multiple layers of like different colors until I kind of get like a blend that I like. And I tend to sort of stick to colors like of the same tones in one print, so I don't end up with like a muddy brown. I also realized I don't actually understand color theory like at all. And I probably should have taken like a painting class at some point in art school, but.
Right. Yeah.
That was one of the reasons I went to SVA. It was like, they let you skip all those core art classes where you learn like the science of art. Like, I was like, no, just put me in the dark room. I don't need to know that shit. Oops. So yeah, they come out looking like watercolors, basically, but they're actually photo prints. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
There's some cool videos on YouTube, Chris, if you really want to deep dive in it. You should, because it's...
Yeah.
Now, are you doing large format with that? Is that how you do it?
I usually start out with either a medium format or a 4x5 negative.
Okay.
And then you have to have a contact negative to make the print with. So I use Lith film for that. They make like... I think it's designed for screen printing stuff, for making the negatives to print the screens. But you can, if you develop it. So usually traditionally Lith film only gives you black and white instead of shades of gray. But if you use like Select All or like other like soft developers, it'll give you shades of gray. And so then you can get like a pretty like tonally rich large contact negative, and they sell it in, I don't know, huge sheets. I think I've seen up to 20x24, but I'm pretty sure it gets bigger, and you might be able to buy rolls of it. I'm not even sure. So you could theoretically do like very large prints, but then it's a matter of how are you going to expose it and how are you going to develop it? Because it does need to be developed like laying flat, and like you really do kind of need a piece of glass to put over the print, even if you're exposing it with sunlight. Like, so I don't know where you're going to find a 4-foot piece of glass, but
yeah. Not anywhere cheap, especially now.
That's such a neat process too, because I remember when I was in high school, I did screen printing. It was like a class that they offered, and I, of course, took it because it was a lot of fun. And, you know, the first round, you're doing hand-cut stencils. The second time, you're doing emulsion stencils. And I didn't realize that it was so much like that until you said that. Because when you're doing stencils, you know, it's usually lettering and it's not the shading. There barely is shading or anything like that. Like, there's no, like, gradient if you're doing a t-shirt design. It's usually, like, pretty solid lines, a lot of negative and positive space kind of stuff. So that's really neat that there is a way to kind of make a true negative out of it. I love that alternative process stuff. Is that stuff that you do? Do you do any other kind of stuff like that at the darkroom? Like, do you guys do any like platinum or any other kind of like weird alternative processes at the darkroom?
We have a whole like collection of random chemistry.
Okay.
And like the first two editions of the Christopher James book. So, and like a really awesome, intense UV exposure unit.
Oh, rad. Cool. Yeah.
But we don't have like necessarily like, here's your Van Dyke kit, here's your whatever. We do have like a surplus of cyanotype stuff. So like, there is that, and there are like a good number of people doing cyanotypes. Camille just made this crazy 20-second stop motion video in literally 48 hours last weekend. I have no idea how she did it. She was like telling me how she was going to do this project, and I was like, you're insane. And then she made digital negatives. Okay, so she had her frames like charted out like a contact sheet, and like was doing 13 by 19 prints, cyanotype prints. But she did like, I don't know, like 30 prints with all these little frames, and then she scanned all the prints and chopped them up and stitched them together and made a fucking stop motion video.
That's like, crazy. I love that.
Yeah, it was so cool.
I need to stop being a wuss when it comes to that stuff, because I've always been, I forget who it is.
I'm gonna hurt you.
YouTube. No, it's not. I just need to, you know, it's just one of those things where you're like, yeah, next week I'll get to it.
Totally.
I'll,
you know,
And there's this guy though on YouTube. He does all those, like, I think platinum and palladium are two different things. I'm not 100% sure.
Palladium's like a slightly cheaper version, I think. Okay. I have not done a lot of that because it's platinum. All so prohibitively expensive.
Yeah.
But if somebody wanted to show up with their own, they could.
Yeah. Just the look of it is so mind blowing. Like, oh my goodness. I need.
That's the one thing in photography school that we didn't really touch on any of the alternative process stuff. That's, I mean, our listeners know I don't know any of that.
Yeah.
Because they were teaching us how to like run a business as a photographer, essentially, versus like, we maybe had like a one day, we did a 1 day emulsion lift class. And I was like, you know, in love. I was like, we could do this. Like, wait, one time? We're going to do this one time? Right. That's not fair. You know?
Yeah. I guess. I don't think we even did much at SVA either. Like, most of the like alternative processes stuff that I learned in high school. And I took a class at the Art Institute of Boston when I was in high school. It was, and that, is that where Christopher James was? No, does he work at RISD? I don't remember. Whatever. Anyway, it's got one, it's one of the like they had a really excellent alternative processes like studio. They had like a huge contact printer and like everything that you could want. So it was a dope class.
I mean, even cyanotype, you know what I mean? Like that stuff. Yeah, I have kit where it's like a 2-bottle kit. You paint on some watercolor paper and then do like a transfer. And I even went out and bought some, whatever they are, the sheets, the clear sheets that you print a negative from your negative on to like a laser printer kind of thing. And I was really going for it, but it's so... I was just doing sun, like contact printing, taking it out to the sun and letting it do it. And it's not, I wasn't trying very hard. It was just like during the pandemic, I was like, I'm going to try to do some of my 4x5 negatives in contact prints. And I got some good results, but there's just so much. If you're into printing and alternative process and stuff, it's something. Because I mean, there's so many different ways too. There's like albuminium or whatever it is, where it's like egg whites and stuff like that. Like it gets so crazy. There's so many cool things you can do.
Really incredible.
Yeah.
So are you doing the NFT thing, making art specifically for that? Or do you have any plans to like do a zine or a book or like a gallery show at maybe at Bushwick or anything like that in the future?
I mean, yes and no, right? I have my gum prints up in the gallery at the Dark Room now for probably a couple more weeks.
Cool.
And they're all like up on OpenSea. And I do think at some point, hopefully in the next 6 months, my friend Justin Aversano, who probably some of the people listening to this podcast know the name, just launched this platform called Quantum Art, where they're like releasing collections for photographers specifically. And so I was talking about doing a custom collection for their platform, but he wants it to like 20 gum prints that are new. Like 20 new gum prints.
Get to work.
Is going to take
Jeez.
A while. Yeah. And also I have like 50 black and white prints that I still have to make for him, because I do his black and white printing for his clients and whatnot. And so I'm like, let me get back to you on that. And then like the gray matter project that I was talking about before, I think for the moment, I'm just going to put that like on Instagram, because I do want this documentation.
Can you explain what that is for people?
So it's like, I guess the idea is that it's like a documentation of the progression of the graying of my hair, but also like sort of in conjunction with little like pieces of like how that makes me feel kind of thing.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes. It's, like, it's very good. I
grew up with my whole or a lot of my identity being just like, I love my hair. And I love the like brown and the multidimensionality. But like, I got my first gray hair when I was like 11 or 12 years old. And like, I know that my mom was like pretty much completely gray by the time she was 40. So wow. I'm like, I only have a few more years like left with like any brown hair at all. And I've noticed over the last couple years, the rate at which I'm getting gray hairs is accelerating. So I'm like, I'm going to do a photo, I think, of the back of my head. I have to figure this out in the next like couple of days, but every week until my hair is completely gray. And then it'll be like this interesting little like flip book where you can just like run them and see like boom, 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 boom. Like,
cause I was like scrolling through Instagram and I was like, what is this? And I was like, what? Wait. And then I was like, oh, ooh, like, this is really cool. Cause you know, we're all getting older.
Right.
And it's happening to all of us. And I think my mom, she I don't actually know. She's all gray, but she dyes it. So she says, she has this joke, like, make sure I'm not gray in the casket. Like she's like,
not one my out hair. Of like,
I am not going out. Yeah, I'm not going out with gray hair.
Oh my God.
And, you know, a lot of people, you can pull off like the silver, like, you know, like I'm like, it's so cool to have like, you know, the bob with like the silver hair. And, and I have my dad's hair. So I'm 38 and it's just starting like to come in, and it's right where his is too, like right by our temples is where he's gray. So it's like kind of underneath. If I lift up, it's all there. So I was like fascinated by that. And I just like think that's such a cool, different documentation thing. And I was just like into it. So I'm like excited to see where it comes, where it goes.
That's fun to hear. It's funny because like I wasn't like really like thinking about it like too hard, and I still like am not, and I don't want it to be something that I think about too hard, but like I've had a couple conversations with a couple different people where they're like, that's like really interesting, and I'm like, oh, I thought it was just like sort of navel gazing, but like great, cool.
And it's also interesting because, you know, there's the whole like men get distinguished when they're salt and pepper and they're gray.
Right.
It's like, oh, look how like sexy and handsome. And it's like women are like I'm getting see your old. Roots. Are you going to like take care of that? Or like, you know, like.
And like when I was a kid, my mom was always dyeing her hair. And then like sometime when I was in high school or college, she came home with it all chopped off. And like that was how, and it was all white. It was completely white. She like skipped to gray and like. And like she was using the fucking, you know, at home kits from CVS in the 90s. So she just like totally destroyed her hair. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. Yeah. Like, I feel like that's like pushing yourself into this like box of like trying to be something that you're not. And like that feels very like contradictory to just like me. Like, I'm not very good at pretending to be something I'm not. It doesn't always work to my advantage.
Right. I mean, who knows where I'll be. And because my dad's, he's in his 60s. It's still dark. So maybe I won't even have to deal with it. You know, if I'm like on his track, although my mom is, you know, she's like since 45, I think she's been dyeing her hair, maybe even sooner. So it's crazy.
You'll never know.
Like I said, I'll never know. Maybe I'll just be, you know, a little mousy brunette for into my 80s.
Could be worse.
Yeah.
I love that. That is so cool. Just because I've never really cared, obviously, because it is easier for guys to just kind of be gray and that's it. And like, but yeah. Just in the last year of like the pandemic, like really took its toll on my gray hair. It was so weird because my beard, I don't know, it's like all that's white. You know what I mean? It's not that I don't have hair there. It's just I'm turning into Santa Claus, and it's okay. Like I'll be the jolly little, but yeah. And I even see that with my own mother. Like I remember when I was coming home, when I had to move home too from the pandemic, she was like, just so you know, I haven't dyed my hair in like a year or something. And I'm like, oh, whatever. And then I saw it and I was like, that actually looks really cool, because there's something about dyeing your hair that it feels like it gives you this almost, well, to me, when I see people like that, where it's obvious, where it's very noticeable, it feels like they're like grasping at straws to hang on to something that almost seems more sad than just letting it be what it is. You know,
it's totally. Yeah.
Don't let me speak on behalf of women, though. I'm sorry.
No, but I think you're summing it up like pretty well. Like that sounds about right to me. Like.
We'll be right back with a couple listener questions for Lucia after this message from our sponsor.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Just wanted to pop in quick and let you guys know about our Patreon Develop and Hang Nights. Now, this is a Patreon-only exclusive. We've done a bunch already. They're a ton of fun. We laugh, we develop some film, we talk shop. It's just a good time. We've done a bunch already. If that sounds like something you're interested in, head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. Patreon is the best way to help support the show. Thanks, guys.
All right, guys, this is a part of the show where we break off and take a question from one of our listeners. We're actually going to do two questions. The first one comes from Han, friend of the show, and she asks, a lot of your photos have water as a recurring theme. Is this purposeful?
I guess I would say that it has sort of become purposeful. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know exactly like when it started. But I mean, I guess like I probably started when I was a kid, actually, because we used to do a lot of camping in upstate New York and go climbing around in the gorges a lot. And so I was always kind of shooting that stuff. But over the last few years, since I did a residency in 2015 in South Carolina, where I strictly focused on waterfalls. And that was the first time I was consciously like, here's the like water element tying this project together. I'm, you know, going exploring, looking for waterfalls, and I'm going to photograph them and turn them into prints and blah, 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 blah. And then since then, I've sort of been like toying with that idea and trying to think of like how I can maintain like sort of water as like a central element of the image, but not necessarily in such a like totally literal way. So that's why I'm interested in like the desert and the jungle, as well as like the beach. And like I'm just like, well, okay, so that actually actually means that I can shoot any type of landscape that I want, because water is essential to landscapes and earth and whatever. You can see it or not, whether it's like directly like the central focus or not, you can see like the impact that it's had. And I mean, then you can like circle back to climate change and all of this stuff and the importance of whatever and natural beauty and like this isn't going to be around for much longer, blah 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 blah. Yeah.
That's a great answer.
It is a good answer.
And I just love, I'm such a big fan that gum prints are like your medium, like that's your thing. Like,
and they develop it.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Are you a swimmer? Is it?
Not really. I grew up doing a fair amount of sailing because I grew up in New England, but I get. I'm kind of more terrified of the ocean, especially with all the fucking sharks and shit. Like, I just.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know, it's getting scarier instead of the other way around. Eels, you know, I listened to that Silky Love episode of Radiolab, which if you haven't listened to, you need to listen to. That changed my life. I don't know.
I don't know if I need to be scared of something else. I'm already terrified of everything.
Yeah.
I need a bubble to live in.
You do.
Well, good answer. And
yes, great answer.
We're going to take one more question. And this question comes from Tree Ryan. And they wanted to know, how has working with The Darkroom changed your views on photography? It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, kind of like, I guess, like in what sense? And also like, I don't know, because I don't know what my views would be if I weren't doing The Darkroom. But also like compared to where I was before. Or I don't know. I mean, I still feel the same way like about photography. Like I still feel like it's like democratizing and should be accessible and like very important in terms of like documenting history. And I feel like film is super important because it's archival and like all of these things. But I have a different sense of who the people shooting film are now than I would if I weren't.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's like I'm doing customer service now. It's not like I'm out like taking pictures and making art all day, every day. I'm like doing a lot of customer service. And so I've learned a lot about people and their attitudes more than about like, or more than anything that would like change my thinking about photography. Like I've learned a lot more information about how things work and how to do things and how to use different machines and all of this stuff, but my like fundamental like feeling and thinking about photography hasn't really changed, I don't think. But photographers, I went from art school to doing customer service, so those are pretty different demographics.
But it's good to hear you're not like getting burnt out on photography. Like
I mean, if I were like gonna have a nervous breakdown and run away from everything, I would make sure to bring my camera, you know. Like I would not be like running away from the dark room. I'd be running away from the people.
Because that's how I kind of looked at the question, was, you know, I don't want to be a wedding photographer, a portrait photographer. I don't want my job to be really photography related kind of thing. That's why it's hard for me to do YouTube videos. I mean, thankfully this podcast is fun and easy to do, that it doesn't involve me burning out photography. I was just kind of looking at it in that aspect of working in a field that you love personally and that you use kind of personally to get your...
Yeah. I don't have a lot of time to do my own shit. So like the time I get to do my own shit is like cool.
Yeah,
but it also is kind of hard to motivate. And like, I'm definitely not as productive as I was when I was in school, but I'm also not in school anymore and running a business. Yeah. So like, I mean,
I think that's what they call the real world, unfortunately.
Yeah. Right.
Growing up.
Gotta pay the bills.
Yeah. Like, growing up.
Just make art. Hopefully I can fit them in together.
I wanted to ask you one more question about running a darkroom. It's super inspirational to me that it's a woman-owned, woman-founded space. Do you run into any issues with that sometimes?
I mean, mostly not, but like occasionally. Okay. I mean, you do get the dude that comes in and just doesn't feel like he has to hear anything that you're saying or acknowledge anything that you're saying, and definitely knows more than you because he's been shooting film for 5 years. Like, really, bro?
Yeah.
Gross.
So like that kind of shit happens, but I don't feel like from people in the industry or anything, there's any really weird or like necessarily negative shit. I don't know. I kind of tend to try and stick to myself. So maybe there's a whole group of people out there that are talking a lot of shit. I don't know. It's entirely possible. But
hopefully not.
Like, they're over there. Yeah. And like, they can stay over there. And for the most part, people are chill and respectful. Yeah. I don't think a lot of people really think about who owns the business for the most part. You know, I think more people are just like, oh, it's a dark room. Oh, I can drop off my film. Oh, I can like whatever, whatever, whatever. And like, it's not really a like big deal for most people. And then some people figure it out that's and they're good. Like, oh, that's cool. I am like in some book or something, I guess, about being, I think it's about being a female small business owner. I don't know. Oh. It's not out yet.
We're happy to celebrate it here on Analog Talk. I think it's a wonderful thing.
Yay.
So
tough question time.
Tough questions. Okay. If you were speaking of running away to a desert island and grabbing your camera, what camera would you bring and why?
Oh, but see, that's an easy one. That's just my Hasselblad because I have a Hasselblad.
I just got one and I'm obsessed.
Right? It's like you don't need anything else ever.
So good. Yeah. And I was like totally not into Square for like such a long time. And now I'm like in love.
Yeah. As I started on the Square, I was like all about it. And I was trying to use Holga's for a few years and like couldn't even like fucking get exposures from them because they were just so leaky.
They are. Yeah. They're a pain.
Yeah. How long have you had your Hasselblad?
I got it in 2007 or 8.
The long game. Yeah.
Yeah. I found it for like $800 on eBay. It was like a crazy deal. Wow. I was like, credit card.
I'll figure it out. I'll figure it out.
Something like that for $800.
That's so good. Great answer. Second part.
Yes.
Is there any cameras that you are dying to get your hands on and want to shoot or want to try? Any white whale, anything you're lusting after right now?
I mean, not really, except that like the other week I found these two little point and shoots like in my drawer. I think one's an Olympus and one's a Yashica. And I would like to get them working because I haven't had like a little pocket camera in a really long time. And I'm sort of like, I mean, I do like take photos with my iPhone. I realize like that's my pocket camera. Like, and I do like flip through them sometimes just to be like, oh yeah, look at that. You know, like I do kind of look at my own photos. So I'm like, what if I had a snapshot camera that shot film? Like, I don't have a snapshot camera that shoots film.
I think that's important for the arsenal. Yeah.
Yeah, right? It really is. Because sometimes you're in situations where you're like, I'm not going to bring the Hasselblad, you know?
Right. And these are little things that have flashes. So I could just be like shooting wherever and like taking the kind of casual photos that I'm developing for all these people. Like, I could do that. Why am I not documenting my life on film ever?
Like, yeah, you need to get on that.
Right.
I know.
So I guess that's my next project. Okay.
Sweet.
And hold you to it. If it's a Yashica that's in your drawer that's not working, you got to get that figured out. It's a great camera.
Yeah, I think they're both like kind of pretty nice cameras with like pretty nice lenses. Yeah. And I'm like, I think I need to like make this kind of a priority and stop just staring at them and take them to like Nippon or whatever. Like,
yes.
Cool. Great answers. Both great answers.
Yeah.
Anything else, Timothy?
I think that's it.
Yeah, this was great to hang out with you again.
Yeah, nice to chat.
Sometimes technical difficulties work out for the better.
Yeah.
Where can everybody check, first of all, you out, and then where can they find out info about Bushwick Community Dark Room?
So we both have, I guess, all the social media and websites. I believe I'm Lucia.Rollo at everything. I think I changed it for Twitter and Instagram. And then my website is just LuciaRollo.com. It's LuciaRollow. And then the Dark Room is, for social media, it's Bushwick DKRM instead of Dark Room being written out. It's just DKRM. And then the website is just bushwickcommunitydarkroom.com.
Yeah. And anybody in New York, drop in because I'm jealous. And I will, next time I'm in New York, I'm going to make it a.
Come say hi.
Yeah.
We're stop on my itinerary. Yes.
Cool.
Amazing. Well, yeah, thanks again. Timothy, where are you?
Guys, you can find me on Instagram. It's at Timothy Makeups. Also on Twitter under the same handle. Also got some YouTube videos. Go to the search bar. Just type in Timothy Makeups. Easiest way to find it. Chris, that's it for me. Where are you?
I am Crispy Photo on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We're Analog Talk Pod on Twitter, Analog Talk Podcast on Instagram. We have a Facebook page and a group you can join and share photos and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
That's it.
Great.
All right, guys. We'll see you in the next one. Bye.
All right, that's going to wrap it up for this episode. First off, we'd like to thank Lucia for coming on the show, actually taking the time twice to record with us. We had some technical issues the first time, and we're so glad we made this happen. You have such a great story. The Bushwick Darkroom is amazing. Hopefully we can get ourselves and visit the Darkroom. Like, how it would just be so awesome to come check it out. Thank you so much. We love what you're doing. Guys, that's going to take us to Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. For only $1, you can get the show 2 days early. We also have a bunch of other things over there, our develop and hang nights. And as I said before, Patreon is the best way to help support the show. For the Patreons already who help support the show, guys, we do not know what we would do without you. We greatly appreciate each and every single one of you. We also want to thank Filmstock for sponsoring this week's episode. Guys, head over there, check it out, use the discount code. They're doing great things for the community. That's going to be it for this week's episode, guys. Until next week, we'll see you soon. Later.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.